5 years after Lucy graduated from college, in October, too early in the morning to possibly be good news, Lucy telephones, "Mom, Dad died." At once, I'm remembering, I'm glad to have the memory of her father, Jack, my ex-husband, resting his hand on my shoulder for a moment at Matt's wedding 2 years earlier, as we stood looking at the funny organizational chart that Lucy, Jack's and my daughter, had drawn so the wedding guests could understand who had been married to whom and whose children were whose in our complicated extended family. It was the only time Jack had touched me since I had left him when Lucy was 2 and a half. I am remembering the wide, smooth expanse of his strong chest as a young man, his honey-streaked hair, how white the whites of his blue eyes had been, our brief happiness, Lucy's birth. In New Hampshire, I wake to tears this day of Jack's funeral, from a dream that he's getting helped, getting dressed, out of a bath or shower. I see that broad chest and back and say, "Oh, Jack, you moved, you got up. You're not really lying in that coffin." I stumble up out of bed, aware it's light, aware it's raining, chilly, mournful weather outside, and I go into the hotel bathroom to take off my nightgown, see my naked body in the mirror and cry, remembering our two living bodies so long ago. Jack looked in his coffin the night before like a wooden cigar store mannequin, his brow, his nose, his face painted, his once golden hair dull, dry. He looked like Jack, only dead, only dead, only dead. All the memories have been let out and are flying about, and I grieve for that sad marriage and divorce and for whatever pretty things there were before the years of ugly things. Later, I clean off from the bottom of my shoes the mud from Jack's grave. Three years later, I wake at Matt and his wife's house into an instant knot behind my right eye as their three-year-old Henry yells, "Daddy!" I go into the hall from the TV room where Ben and I have been sleeping and say softly outside the door of Henry's room, "It's not time yet, Henry. Go back to sleep." Then I hear him saying, "Oma, Oma, Oma," my preferred term for grandmother, the way my mother had used with her grandchildren. And to Henny's muted chorus, I go downstairs to make coffee, to get Henry's milk in his sippy cup, and come back up to see Ben lifting him out of his crib, which looks Lilliputian now. Henry towers in it, but he's not asking yet to have a real bed. And I see with gladness my grandson's lovely, sleepy face. He and I have a little visit then in the TV room, before I become resigned to turning on the program Dino Dan. "What did you dream?" I always ask. He furrows his brow, thinking. I know he's making it up for me. He answers, after quite a while, "A long train." "Oh," I say. "I dreamt I gave away a diamond ring." He looks thoughtfully at me. I turn on the TV and Henry lines up Charlie, his red bear, Baby Bunny, a stuffed bunny, and Baby, a naked plastic doll. "He's bald," Henry explains, under the pretty knitted blanket his other grandmother made for him. And he instructs them about Dino Dan. I do like Dino Dan. It's made in Canada. I like Dan's spacious, comfortable, old-fashioned brick house on a tree-lined open street. The house, a big square one with a nice round attic window, reminds me of one of the houses I grew up in. Matt's squat, solid little dog, his plastic bone in his mouth, comes up and rolls his buggy eyes and makes a little grunting noise. He wants to come up on the sofa, and despite his short legs, makes the leap, then backs up into me, as is his funny style, to touch. I'm pretty happy watching Dino Dan with warm Henry and his entourage of stuffed toys on one side, the warm dog on the other. I like looking at the young, strong mother of Dan and thinking about back when I was like her. It's later in the afternoon, and I've read and sung Henry to sleep. I'm excited to see you, he'd said to me when I first arrived. I'm glad, I'd replied, because I've missed you. I missed you too, he'd said. We'd smiled at one another. Henny, I'd said, we're traveling through time together. We are? He'd asked. Yup, I'd replied. You've been traveling for 3 years, and I've been traveling 65 years. You have? He'd said, wonderingly. Now it's what I think of as the grandmother's hour, that sleepy afternoon time of little children napping, the dog in, and nothing to do or needing to be done in the outside world. That's fine with me. But how restless it used to make me as a young mother. I remember how forlorn and left out I sometimes felt when Lucy was small and I was home, and Matt would be coming home from school, but I didn't feel cozy or content because Jack, who could not see me, was my husband. I was lonely, and I longed for more life. Oh, how things change and change. Now Matt is out living, and I'm home with his son, and Jack is dead. Several years later, Lucy's 2-year-old daughter, Rosie, is visiting Ben and me. She tells her mama as her pajamas are being put on that she wants to cuddle with me. So she and I come into the couch in our TV room, and I read her a little Beatrix Potter book. To my surprise, on the front page is written to Lucy from Grandmother and Granddaddy, Jack's parents. Rosie points to the picture, says, Mommy Rabbit? Daddy Rabbit? Then, many rabbits? Many is her favorite new word. And the night before, in this enchanted time before bed, she'd looked around our living room and said, many lamps. Now, after we look at the book, she keeps lying up against me or lying out on the couch with her head on my lap, constantly shifting position and saying, hi, Oma. And I reply, hi, Rosie. Rosie, I missed you. I'm so glad to see you. And stroke her hair and face. She turns over on her belly and puts her face practically between my legs as if sensing the mothership, then says, hi, Oma, over and over. It's what she can verbalize. I imagine it takes the place of, I missed you, I'm happy to be together again, I love you. All of this feels contained inside the, hi, Oma. Ben comes in smiling, eager to be with us, and sits next to me. Then Lucy comes in too, and then her visiting 24-year-old half-sister, Jack's daughter, who I call my half-daughter. She joins us, and, delighted, we have Rosie across our 4 laps. Lucy said she needs me all of this hot month in New York City, and so I'm there. My back hurts, and I'm tired, but I have the beauty of Rosie and also of my daughter's belly rippling with the new baby boy due any day. He was tumbling around inside Lucy last night as we sat together on the sofa watching a documentary about Bin Laden, a weird juxtaposition, terrorism, and a new life safe and enclosed. Big storms. Munder, says Rosie. But they come to nothing. Like Lucy's many pains, that's the feeling of these days, this huge event, the birth, which, like the storm, is building and rumbling, but not yet arriving. Ben is flying from home in Illinois towards us, and it will be such a help to have him. Lucy and I will be able to complete a sentence, and Ben and Rosie enjoy each other so much. In the afternoon, Lucy takes me up on my offer to massage her back. Rosie is asleep, Lucy's husband is at work, and real contractions 3 minutes apart have begun. Earlier, as we were walking back from the park and I was behind her, I felt tender and anxious looking at her waddling, her belly distended like a mare's, and as she told me, aching from the pressure of this baby. Now, because she's asked, I sit behind her, me on the couch, her on the ottoman in front of me, between my legs, to rub her back and shoulders as we wait for her husband to arrive to take her to the hospital. I lift her heavy, glossy hair from her neck. Soon, her husband, excited and nervous, arrives, and off they go. Rosie finally gets an intense longing for her mama. After 2 days of Ben and me caring for her with her daddy going back and forth and her visit to mama and her new brother at the hospital, she points at the green chair where mama usually sits and says, "Mama, hold you," which is her way of saying, "hold me." She begins to cry, "Mama, mama, mama, hold you." But I could hold her. And then daddy took her to bed, and then mama came home. So if I were to end these stories, how would I end? Perhaps at the scene in which I hear the resonant and melancholy chime of a clock downstairs in the spare and empty lobby of the old Vermont Inn, where I've been sitting at a smooth wooden table for the past hour, writing in my diary with my blue fountain pen and a cup of coffee and a single lamp burning because I'm the only one awake since 5 a.m. And it's so peaceful here, so quiet, and the wooden counter of this 1795 Stagecoach Inn is thoughtfully prepared with a modern one-cup-at-a-time coffee machine, little tubs of cream, bowls of sugar and sweetener so that any guest like me who's up early and needs her cup can descend, make it, and sit in perfect peace in this tranquil, clean, old-fashioned, courteous room with its wing-back chairs and its graceful brass chandelier. The clock has struck 6 a.m. Soon the mild-faced older woman on the inn's staff, an older woman like me, who walks quietly about and turns on lights, will be coming in, and I think, that is the chime of time, and everything I have always been writing about in my diaries is about time and its passing and going back in it and resting from it an understanding of my years and of what my time on this earth has been about. This trip up here to these towns in New Hampshire and its neighbor Vermont, these small towns in which my most formative adult years were passed, because those years included the births of my son, Matt, and my daughter, Lucy, two marriages and two divorces, the death of my dear friend, Rachel, my finding sobriety, and my meeting Ben, with whom I have spent the past 35 years in love and in love's struggles. This trip will likely be my last visit to these places, and through these places, my last visit to those times spent here, which of course have been long over, long past, and yet which perhaps only if you have left the places and don't see them day to day, don't see them for years, for decades, seem to keep alive in them those times you spent there, as if in a movie you could replay, watch again, except you're the only one who sees it because it is inside your head. This final visit has been overfull of all of those ghosts of my past, and I am ready, finally, to leave them, to leave the past behind. Now the past is by far most of my life, 70 years to think over and ponder, as I keep moving in the stream of time into my shorter and shorter future towards the end of my own story. How is it, I wonder, that I didn't ever really understand that the past never comes back? This was the last day of my trip here, my last day in the old Vermont Inn, a day with Rachel's daughter, Abby, now almost 40 years old, older than her mother Rachel was when she died. A day with Rachel's son, Joshua, last seen by me when he was 4. With his sweet wife and their little girl and little boy, Rachel's grandchildren. Abby came to get me this morning where I waited outside on the inn steps and drove me to see Joshua and his family, then later to the farm where her father still lives. The rooms in Rachel's house where I spent that last day with her look just the same. And as we sat outside on the deck in the sun, Abby in her dark sunglasses, her shining dark hair, looked so much like her mother, Rachel. I felt I was in a dream, somehow transposed back in time. Her voice sounds like Rachel's. Perhaps the past, in some ways, does come back. When we left the farm, it was dusk. The earth around us was an early spring, only a few weeks later than the last time I was there 34 years ago. The road was so narrow, unpaved, bumpy with the sound of gravel against the wheels, that branches of the trees in these wooded acres around the farm brushed against the car. The sun was slanting down. Abby said, "I'm glad you came." I felt as though Rachel's spirit was with us, that there were three of us there together. I felt a letting go, a feeling that I had in some small way been able to keep my promise to Rachel. All three of us were there in that car, in that moment, near Rachel's farm, near where she lay in her grave. Abby and I went to eat dinner in the restaurant where, until a friend had reminded me, I'd forgotten that Rachel and I had always gone to share our birthday celebration lunch. Then Abby brought me back to the inn, and we had the woman at the desk take a picture of us together and hugged goodbye. I head up the stairs to my room. Now that it's nighttime in the old Vermont Inn, the lamps are all glowing in the lobby living room. I'm tired. Weary. I am no longer young, at 70, and I need to go to bed. I'm pleased that in my room in the Vermont Inn there's an old beauty of a desk, but when I open it to place its writing surface down to write these final thoughts, I see that it's broken inside, dusty, not likely to have been used by any other guests, because people don't write much by hand these days. I hear that cursive writing is no longer even taught in school. And few people use a fountain pen, like my blue one, which has run out of ink, and so I'm using a blotchy ballpoint. But writing, even with a bad pen, is still my solace, my listening friend, my advisor, my counselor, my lamp. This antique walnut desk with cubby holes, a secretary desk, is almost exactly like the one I used as a child, the one that was in my mother's room before I was old enough to have it in my own. It was my great-grandmother's desk, which I still have at home, which still bears a black burn on its edge where Mother once carelessly left a cigarette. I'm saving it to pass on to Rosie once she's old enough to write.